From NPR Music, I'm Tom Huizinga, and the man of the hour is Giuseppe Verdi. Two 200 years ago, in a little northern Italian village near Busseto, Verdi was born. He would later insist on calling himself a simple peasant, but he was far more than that. Verdi found thrilling new possibilities and new expression in combining words and music that made him one of the great figures in music. And here today to help us celebrate Verdi at 200 is one of today's most exciting young Verdi sopranos, Angela Mead. Angela, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You know, people are calling you a Verdi soprano. Is that a title that fits?
I guess it does because I sing so much Verdi. It's never how I describe myself, but I guess that title would sort of work.
How are you describing yourself these days?
I've always sort of described myself as a big lyric soprano with an extension and coloratura capabilities. Some people put that into a dramatic coloratura Fach, but I don't really like to label myself, really.
Well, we're glad you're here because, like you say, you have been singing quite a bit of Verdi lately. You're about to sing in Falstaff at the Met, and last season you sang, I Lombardi, right?
Yes.
Also Verdi's Requiem.
Yes.
Vesperi Siciliani.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
And there's got to be one more. Trovatore?
And Trovatore, yes.
So we asked you to play a guest DJ to take some of your favorite Verdi music along and spin it for us. But before we start, I'd like to kind of put your Verdi credentials on display. And thanks to the Met Opera, we have an aria you sang on stage there from Verdi's Ernani. Here's just a little portion of the aria, Ernani in Volami. And I guess if this doesn't prove that you are a Verdi soprano, I don't know what does. Let's take a listen. How do you do that?
I don't know. Which part are you listening to?
All of it. I mean, the great Messa de Voce at the end. I mean, it's all fantastic, especially the Messa de Voce, we should say, is it's when the voice starts small and then blooms really big and then gets it small again. I mean, that is just awesome singing.
Well, thank you. It's certainly easier in certain parts of the voice than others. It actually is easier above the passaggio in the higher range.
And the passaggio is, explain that for the listeners who don't know what that is.
What's called a break in the voice, a transition from one part of the voice to another. So if you're moving from the more chest mix into head voice. So in a soprano, it's around D, E, F up at the top of the staff. So notes to Messa de Voce on like a B flat is actually quite easy to do it on.
Easy for you. easy for you. The voice is, it's large and it's beautiful and it moves easily. It's a combination, I think, that we don't really find that much around today.
Well, thank you.
And I mentioned a moment ago that people are thinking of you as the next great Verdi soprano. I mean, what does it really mean? What is a Verdi soprano?
I think how you just described it, with a voice that's large enough to cut over the orchestration of Verdi, but at the same time has beautiful qualities to it, but is able to sing fioritura and coloratura and able to sing all of the dynamics that Verdi wrote. So you're able to sing a forte, you're able to sing in your chest voice, you're able to sing pianissimo high notes. Like you said, that doesn't happen a lot, which I think is why you don't see a lot of Verdi sopranos.
So we've asked you to bring Verdi, and you've come with a nice big pile of some of your favorite Verdi. Where should we start?
I think maybe we should start with Ernani.
Okay, a little bit more from the opera that we just heard from, and I'm sure that this opera holds a very special place in your heart.
It does, as it was my step onto the professional scene, my Met debut, but my professional debut all in one evening.
Tell us how that happened.
I was singing in the Met National Council auditions in 2007, which is now documented in the documentary The Audition.
Right.
And I sang in the grand finals and I won. And the next day, the Met wrote an email to me asking me if I would be interested in covering Elvira in Hernani the following season. And they asked me the next day.
The next day. Wow. So you're already kind of euphoric that you won and you went out and nailed this Casta Diva from Norma as your final piece. And then and you must have been just on cloud nine. And then the next day you get this email.
I remember sitting at my desk reading this email and I literally almost fell out of the chair. And I thought, wow, this is not happening. But it did. So I prepared for it. And I was still a student at the Academy of Vocal Arts at this time. And so I asked them for a release, and of course they kindly granted it to me, and I prepared it, and I went up there, and maybe not luck, I don't think Sandra would see it as luck, but Sandra Ravanovsky was singing the role, and she took ill actually on the first night, but continued to sing, and then by the second evening of the show, she was totally out of commission, and they asked me if I would step in. And on the stage I went.
And that was your professional debut on the stage of the Met.
In a leading role.
How many other people have done that? Probably not too many.
Not a lot. There's only a handful.
So, nerves?
I think I was too ramped up to be nervous.
Uh-huh. So, we're starting with Hernani, obviously. A very important opera for you. It's this kind of out-of-control Spanish political romance with plenty of backstabbing, and actually literal stabbing as well. plenty of action for the hero, who's like this bandito Hernani from the hills of Aragon, and the woman he loves, Elvira. It was a early opera for Verdi from 1844, his fifth opera, and quite a bit of success. Tell us about the scene that you picked here.
So this is the very end of the opera. It's in the fourth act. Elvira comes screaming back onto stage, screaming ferma, which means to stop. Hernani has said, fine, I will go ahead and stab myself. And he raises the knife to do it, and she runs in and says, no, stop, what are you doing? We're both going to die if you do this, because I'll have to kill myself because I love you so much. So
it's the tragic ending.
It is the tragic ending.
Where, needless to say, the two lovers finally get together at the very end of the opera. Mm-hmm. And we think we're going to have a happy ending.
But alas.
But alas, it's opera. So in this scene, who are we going to hear singing now?
So this is a 1969 recording of Montserrat Caballé singing Elvira and Bruno Prevedi as Hernani, and conducted by Gavazzini at La Scala.
All right, let's hear it. One of the final scenes from Verdi's Hernani, and the star soprano there is Montserrat Caballé. I'm Tom Huizinga, and we're celebrating the 200th anniversary of Giuseppe Verdi's birth with Angela Mead, a great Verdi soprano. And she's brought along a lot of Verdi recordings. Where should we go next?
Why don't we move to Due Foscari?
Due Foscari. Now, this is another opera from the same year. He was busy in 1844,
yes,
Verdi was, because it's his sixth opera. He wrote it for Rome, and he was riding this wave of success. He already had kind of like three hits in a row, Nabucco and Lombardi and Hernani. And Here we have like this 15th century Doge of Venice who, forced to keep the kind of strict Venetian laws, condemns his only surviving son to exile.
Yes.
A sad story.
It is sad.
With sad people.
It is.
And there's some sad music, but it's beautiful music.
There is some sad music. It's actually one of my favorite. There's a lot of really great music in this score.
Have you sung any of this at all?
I have. I sang it actually in Berlin in May of 2012 at the Deutsche Oper in a concert version with Ramon Vargas and Leonucci.
Nice.
Yeah.
There's some virtuosic fiery music for Lucrezia, the soprano in this opera. And you've picked out this aria called Ah, Sposo Mio, Ah, My Husband, from Act Two. What's
it's actually
here?
More of a duet than it's actually a duet.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Yeah. He, like you said, he's been exiled for a murder that he didn't commit, so he's been falsely accused. And she comes in and finds him, and she thinks he's dead. She's checking his pulse, and then all of a sudden he wakes up, and he thinks that he's seeing her in a vision. And she's like, no, I'm actually here. And it's really sad that it doesn't get done very often because it's great music.
That's true. So let's hear this duet between Jacopo, right, the exiled son who's in prison, and Lucrezia. And here we've got the Lucrezia of Katia Ricciarelli and the Jacopo of Jose Carreras.
Yes.
Especially difficult here for the soprano?
Not in this particular segment that you're playing, but the part is very difficult. She's very histrionic the entire time, and her music sort of really shows that the way that it's written. She sounds histrionic the entire time, but she has some really beautiful music with the tenor, and especially the baritone. The end of the first act, the duet is beautiful, but a lot of it lies. Early Verdi for a soprano lies in the passaggio, like we talked about earlier, and above it.
That's something that suits your voice well.
It does.
Yeah. We're celebrating Verdi with Angela Mead, and I'm Tom Heisengetz, NPR Music, and we've just heard Katia Ricciarelli with Jose Carreras in music from the Little Heard opera from Verdi called I Due Foscari. So you've got a lot more Verdi on your pile. Where should we go next?
Let's go to Vespri.
The Vespri Siciliani, the Sicilian Vespers from, let's see, now we're at about 1855. It's actually an opera that Verdi wrote in French.
He did.
For Paris.
He did. He wrote it for Paris Opera. And from what I've read, it wasn't a huge hit the first time around. And then he rewrote it in Italian. Some years later.
He actually, from what I recall, he had a little bit of a hard time getting it produced in Paris, and actually at one point asked the officials at the Paris Opera to, like, he wanted to get out of it and just cancel, and they said no way, and so he soldiered on, and it did have about 50 performances, and then as soon as it ended, he immediately had it translated into Italian, and I guess that's the version we normally hear today, right?
Yeah, I think it's the one that's mostly done. Now, I have just done it in at Caramore in French, which is unusual.
So compared to the three operas that preceded this one, I Vespri Siciliani, we've got Traviata, Trovatore, Rigoletto, pretty big hitting operas there. Some kind of see Vespri as a little bit of a letdown, I would imagine. Why did you choose this one?
I made my Wiener Staatsoper debut in this role, and I found that I really, really love the music. I think it's very reminiscent of a lot of the early Verdi, but it's late. It's late Verdi, actually. Mm-hmm. A lot of the big ensembles are very early Verdi-esque, but a lot of the other things in it, you can really feel the growth that Verdi has gone through, her arias in particularly. It's a lot of great music, and I really love how it kind of harkens back to that.
Mm-hmm. The story is about the 13th century subjugation of the Sicilians under the French. Now, I have to ask you about this, about the scene that you've chosen. I mean, the opera ends with a wedding scene that is like none other anywhere in opera. Tell us what
it all goes wrong
in a very big way.
Okay, so it's a very convoluted plot, like, well, most Verdi plots, right? Elena, the soprano, her brother has been killed by the French regime, and the person in charge of it, who is Monforte, the baritone.
The bad guy.
One of the bad guys. There's more than one in this opera. The bass is also a bad guy. So she, of course, is in love with the tenor, and they want to be together. But Monforte has offered the tenor, Arrigo, a position in the French army.
That's right.
And he says, the offer is, I'll give you this position if you leave Elena alone. And he says, no, I love her. I want to be with her. And then Procida, who's the bass, he's hatching a plot to
overthrow the French,
because he is a Sicilian. And Arrigo and Elena are about to get married. And Procida sort of interrupts it, and, you know, they try to hatch this plan, and she says, I'm not going to go along with it. And Arrigo thinks that she's been unfaithful to him. And this is where this piece starts. He starts calling her all sorts of names. He thinks she's been unfaithful because she won't go away with him. And she's really doing it just in order to save his life, because Procida has hatched the plan so that when the two of them are married and the bells ring, that's when the massacre is to start.
A massacre at a wedding.
I know, right? So Monforte, who doesn't know that this is about to happen, comes in and says, why are you guys not getting married? I told you to go ahead and get married. And so he joins their hands, and she tries her best to get away, and it doesn't happen. He joins their hands, the bells ring, and the massacre starts, and that's how the opera ends.
It's, like I said, it's a wedding like none other that you can imagine. It's like, you may now kiss the bride, and...
And you're all dead.
And you're all dead.
Yes.
So a strange ending to an opera with a lot of really great music in it. And here we have a recording you chose by whom?
This is Arroyo and Domingo and Raimondi, conducted by Levine in 1974.
Okay, so here's When Good Weddings Go Bad. Dio per ta fatale a me fatal di la l'arma Final scene from Verdi's opera I Vespri Siciliani, and that was Martina Arroyo, soprano, with Placido Domingo and Cheryl Milnes. It was James Levine conducting there. It's one of the choices from our guest Angela Mead, who's helping us celebrate the 200th anniversary of Verdi's birthday by bringing in some of her favorite Verdi recordings. There's a certain intensity to some of these recordings that you've brought, some of them that coming at the very end of the opera, and Verdi does that intenseness in a very special way, it seems. There's nothing quite like it.
Yeah, it's very visceral, and it goes right into your heart, and I think a lot of the Verdi roles that I sing, they sort of end with these big emotional scenes, unlike a lot of the big bel canto, like Donizetti things, where they end with soprano singing a gran scena.
Mm-hmm. The a big scene.
The Verdi ones end with these big ensembles that just sort of go right to the heart of what the opera's about.
Do you remember the first opera you ever heard?
I remember the first one I ever saw.
Which was?
Which was Così fan tutte.
What did you think?
I instantly fell in love with it.
How old were you then?
I was in college, so I must have been 20 or so, 21 maybe.
So you had listened to opera before then, or were you kind of a little bit of a latecomer to opera?
I didn't grow up listening to it.
No?
My parents didn't listen to it. I wasn't really exposed to it. I mean, I knew what classical music was and everything because I sang in choir and I played in band and would occasionally sing in solo and ensemble contest in high school, and I would sing a classical piece. But it wasn't until I was at community college and I was singing in the college choir as an outlet because I was taking pre-med classes.
Really?
Yeah. And I was so sick of chemistry and biology and anatomy and everything that I needed to get away. So I was taking the college choir as sort of an outlet, and I love to sing. And the college choir director said, "I know you love to sing. I have a friend who teaches voice lessons if you're interested in taking some." So I went to him, and he gave me a couple of arias. I do remember what those were.
And they were?
Vadoru Pupile from Giulio Cesare of Handel.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And Susanna's aria from Le Nozze di Figaro.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, strangely enough. And I went home and learned them and came back and sang them for him. And it felt like a really natural way for me to sing. And I sort of fell in love with it, and I became very curious about it. And I started reading up on it and listening to things. But I don't remember what the first thing I ever listened to was in complete.
And this is all before you've actually seen an opera, right?
Correct.
I mean, everyone kind of has their stories about how they got hooked on opera, but yours is a little bit kind of through the back door almost.
A little bit.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. I always joke that I sort of fell into it.
Now, I've read that you have entered 57 opera competitions. Is that true?
Okay, I entered a few more than that, but that's how many I won, yes.
That's how many you won?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that was just the number that you had entered.
No,
did you have kind of an addiction to opera competitions?
I don't know if it was an addiction.
Of course, if you keep winning, why not?
Well, yeah, that was exactly the point. I found something that I was really good at, and I thought, why not do this? There's a lot of money to be made in it if you're very good at it.
Wow. I don't know. You know, we've just first met, but you don't really strike me as a super competitive person. Are you, though?
I'm not outwardly competitive. I'm competitive with myself.
Right.
I mean, I'm not that sort of like vindictive competitive person.
Maybe after a dozen or so of these competitions under your belt, did you formulate a strategy to where they were like,
I think my strategy
no
was singing Casta Diva, actually. I think it put so many people on the edge of their seat because they were like, is this girl really singing this aria?
Right.
Is she really ballsy enough to do that? Because I wouldn't even just put it on my list and hope they would pick it. I'd come in and start with it.
I was interviewing J. Paul Driscoll, who was one of the judges for the Liederkranz competition.
Yes.
And he referred to, and you said that you just come out and start singing Casta Diva. And he said, well, what happened was what we call a five-pencil drop. Where the judges all drop their pencils and it's like, okay, is this young woman really gonna sing Casta Diva? Which, if you don't know it, it's a very, very, very difficult aria to sing, one of the most difficult. Obviously, now you're an opera star. You don't need to be in competitions
anymore.
Oh, I'm
retired from them.
You're retired.
All of my colleagues who are about my same age were all happy when I retired.
I can imagine so. But now, speaking of competitions, is being an opera singer a competitive job?
When you actually get to the job, no.
No?
I don't think so. No, I think everybody is very collegial and they help each other and we're all there to do a job and we love what we do. And I don't think it's competitive in that nature. I think it's competitive still to be hired.
Right.
But no, I don't think it's not competitive like doing a competition, no.
Verdi is the man of the hour here. You've brought along a bunch of Verdi to spin. Where should we go next?
Oh, why don't we go to Trovatore?
Il Trovatore was 1853 for Rome, and I don't know, some people might think this is just kind of the ultimate, you know, high-octane Italian opera, very intense, you know, a kind of a violent, outrageous story of revenge, and, you know, there's one killer tune after another. There's who doesn't know the Anvil Chorus? There's Di Quella Pira for the tenor, Stride la Vampa, Tacia la Notte, Il Balin. It's just one right after the other.
Yes.
You sang Trovatore earlier this year at the Met. Was mm-hmm. that your first stage Trovatore?
It was my first staged. I'd done it a couple of times in concert.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And how did that go?
I thought it went marvelously well. I can't wait to go back to it.
The story, of course, is it's easy to kind of poke fun at. The opera writer Dennis Forman called it the one where the gypsy woman throws the wrong baby on the bonfire and thus causes the grown-up unburned baby to be killed by his brother. It's meant to be a little bit confusing, and it's easy to mock it, but it's tough to deny all the excitement in the music.
It is. It might actually be my favorite Verdi. It's really emotional, too, especially something like the fourth act. It's just heart-wrenching what's going on, and it's hard to not sometimes get swept away in that and let myself become overcome with what I'm talking about and singing about.
You ever have that when the music, and either because it's so thrilling or maybe it's so touching that you've got to kind of hold yourself in check?
Sometimes, yeah.
Well, tell us about this scene that you've chosen here. It's where the heroine, Leonora, visits her lover, Manrico, right?
Well, yes, she visits. Well. He's in prison.
It's another one of these prison scenes.
Yes, exactly. That's where the tenor always seems to end up. She comes to the prison to try to help him escape, if she can. This is the Miserere scene. She's been down on her knees praying that her wishes and desires and thoughts will go to him while he's in prison and bring him some comfort and let him just know that she's thinking about him, but to not let him know how pained she is by it.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of her aria, she starts hearing these monks chanting, and she immediately thinks, oh my God, they've already killed him. He's dead. So she's very overcome emotionally. Ai par che la morte con ali di tenebri librandosi vo ma forse dischiuse gli fion queste porte sor quando cadaver già freddo sarà Then she hears him and realizes, oh my God, he's not dead. Oh my God, wait for me. I think that this scene is so difficult because it's so emotional.
And you chose this Maria Callas recording.
Well, why choose Callas? I mean, she exemplifies emotion through her singing that some other artists don't. I feel like when she's singing, she's really fully committed to what she's saying and what she's feeling.
Right. Yeah, it's like every single note, every single word.
And it's not even just that. It's the way she takes breaths and the way she ends notes and breathes in. And you can just feel her pain.
For part of the aria Tu Vedrai that follows the Miserere from the fourth act of Verdi's Il Trovatore with Maria Callas, recorded in 1956. Angela Mead is with us celebrating Verdi's 200th birthday, and where should we go next?
Well, let's talk about Otello.
Otello, the second to the last opera by Verdi, mm-hmm. and why did you pick this one?
It's one of the most beautiful melodies, I think, that that Verdi wrote.
And this is late in the opera. We're talking about the Ave Maria that Desdemona sings.
Yes.
You know, this is inauthentic to Shakespeare. There's no prayer scene in the original Othello. And this comes, you know, late after Othello's been already kind of overheated with jealousy, and then there's this quiet moment with Desdemona. And musically, it's kind of interesting. She just kind of recites this prayer, but...
She does. It's brought back very much to the church tradition of chant.
Right.
She sort of invokes the prayer on no tone really at all. It's sort of Sprechstimme at the beginning. It's written on
she kind of mumbles it almost.
And then she sort of launches into this really beautiful melody, and your heart is just sort of there with her. I mean, she doesn't know yet that she's going to die, but I think she has an inclination. I mean, she asks her maid to lay out her bridal gown in case she dies tonight, and she says, "Stop thinking like that." And then she prays and goes to bed, and then Othello comes in and kills her.
Now, is this a role that you kind of have your sights on down the road, a piece?
I actually sang it already.
Have you sung it already?
Yeah, in Portland, Oregon, this last summer at a small festival called Portland Summerfest. I wanted to get it under my belt, and so they offered it to me.
In a stage version or a
concert?
No, concert version.
Concert.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Well, no wonder you like it so much.
Yeah.
Let's hear it. This is Kiri Takanawa with the Ave Maria from Verdi's Othello.
Ave Maria, piena di grazia, eletta fra le spose, le virgini sei tu, sia benedetto il frutto, o benedetta di tue materne viscere, Gesù.
Kiri Takanawa with the prayer Ave Maria from Verdi's Othello. Is this recording something special for you?
I think that she sings this with such an innocence of tone. She's like an angel when she's singing it. It just seems so pure and simple and authentic. That's
yeah,
why
there's
I really love it.
Silvery, creamy, silvery tone that she has. It was so special.
Yes.
We're celebrating Verdi, and I think we've got time for one more. What have you brought us?
So the last one is not actually an opera, but it should be.
It kind of sounds like one.
It does sound like one. It's got all of the great markings of his great operas, but it's actually his Requiem Mass. I've actually sung this a lot, and...
You've got a last-moment story for this, too, right?
Yes. So I live in Philadelphia, and I know Yannick
Nézet-Séguin, the director of the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Yes, we had worked together previously in Montreal with his orchestra up there. And the soprano was not feeling well, sort of. She was having some allergies and things. And I went to opening night of it in Philadelphia. This was fall of 2012. And I just shot Yannick an email and said, "I'm in town just in case." It was actually on Facebook. You know,
really?
Just to let you know, I'm saying hi. And
these are how operatic deals get made
I
over
guess
Facebook
sometimes,
these days.
Yes. I just really wanted to say hi to him, and I was going to go back and say hi to him after the concert.
Right.
And just to let him know that I was there. And he actually wrote me the next evening and said, "Soprano has decided that she can't sing tomorrow. Can you come and sing?" This was all on Facebook. Isn't that funny how we do things nowadays?
That is amazing.
Yes.
And so you did.
I did. I jumped in.
And now I read that during the curtain calls, he bowed to you. Is that true?
He not only bowed, he got down on his knees and kissed
Seriously?
My hands.
Oh.
Yes. It was very sweet.
That is sweet.
Yes.
So you've chosen this portion from the Requiem that comes from the very end, the Libera Me section. It's the very end, and it's a kind of a long section that spotlights the soprano.
Yeah.
What's going on here?
It's kind of a whole opera unto herself in the last movement. It goes on for 15 minutes, and it's only her. It's the only movement that's specifically for just one voice.
And the chorus. Yes,
which is a huge part in this piece anyway. So she's praying that when the day, when her final moment comes, that she will be granted peace. She wants to be liberated from what's going on. And you can really, I chose this recording of Scotto, who's another person like Kallis. Like, she really digs into the words, and it's all about the words. And you can really hear her begging for mercy and for forgiveness and for peace. And especially the quiet part, the requiem part of the Libera Me, it's so ethereal. And it's actually not anything that I actually associate with Scotto and how she sings. And I was really astonished at how she sings it and how she's able to sound so pure and beautiful. And it's really amazing how she's able to pull that off. But then the next minute she turns back on that fiery Italian right. personality, and she's just growling at you almost.
All right, let's hear it. It's the part of the Libera Me section, the last section of Verdi's Requiem, and it's one of the choices made by Angela Mead, our guest. Renata Scotto, the soprano there, with Riccardo Muti conducting the final section, the Libera Me section from Verdi's Requiem, music from 1874. And it's one of the choices from Angela Mead, and Angela has dropped by today with a mittful of Verdi recordings celebrating the 200th anniversary of Verdi's birth. Thank you so much for coming by.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
It's been really wonderful talking with you, and good luck with your career. You've got Verdi coming up in your future in just a little bit, singing in Falstaff at the Met.
Yes.
So what should we go out on?
I think that we should listen to another favorite Verdi opera of mine that someday I'd like to sing, would be Traviata. And
okay.
This is Addio del Passato.
Thanks again, Angela.
Thank you.